For the New Books Network, this is New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Keith Simmons. Known as the Marvelous City, the Brazilian city of Rio de Janeiro is a Latin American metropolis that has fascinated for centuries, from soldiers to slaves, and from dancers to musicians. Millions have made Rio their home. Dr. Daryl Williams, an associate professor of history from the University of Maryland, is one of the editors for the Rio de Janeiro Reader, History, Culture, Politics, which was recently published by Duke University Press. Dr. Williams joins us now to discuss the book. Dr. Williams, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Keith.
I wonder if we could first start the interview by perhaps talking a little bit about your background, how you came to study history, and in particular, how you came to study the history of Brazil.
Okay, thank you. Thank you again for this opportunity to talk a little bit about myself, but also about my work in Brazil, and particularly most recently in Rio. And those things are intertwined together in interesting, but, you know, unplanned ways. Sometimes people ask me if I am Brazilian or if my family's Brazilian or some sort of personal connection that I have in my childhood to Brazil, and that really the answer is none. I was born in the United States. Both my parents are American, and I didn't really have a connection to Brazil at all. What I did have growing up mainly on the border between the United States and Mexico was an interest and a sensibility to other peoples who are close to the United States but also different in some ways from the United States and North Americans or Americans. And that was particularly true for Mexicans, Mexico and Mexicans, which were quite close to where I grew up. And Mexico is a real place where I went, at least in the border towns of Mexico. And it was also in the 1980s, so some sense about Central America, U.S. intervention in Central America, and some, you know, early stages of understanding of U.S. foreign policy and some issues about justice, social justice. And between those two and an interest just to want to know more about the world, I was very interested in studying Latin American studies. So that started out in high school in a very conventional way of taking Spanish classes. But as I set my sights on college, I really wanted to do Latin American studies. And so I, in part, chose programs that were strong in Latin American studies. And so my undergraduate degree was in history, but with a strong Latin American studies component, and particularly at Princeton, with Latin American studies being such an interdisciplinary certificate program, I really had the opportunity to do history and literature and political science and I can't remember everything now, economics in various ways. And but somewhat by serendipitous chance, I suppose, I had the opportunity to learn Portuguese, to study Portuguese between my sophomore and junior year. And with the basis I already had in understanding or trying to understand about Latin America, the Portuguese language, and particularly Brazilian Portuguese, and that particular sort of language acquisition opportunity I had over the summer was just phenomenal. And I got really, really interested in Brazil as a place that seemed just fascinating and troubling and dramatic, a place where I could think about doing some work on my senior thesis, which began my work on the Vargas period, this period in the 1930s and 40s, in the 50s in Brazil. And it was through that beginning as an undergraduate. My senior thesis was on the coup in 1945, a coup which overthrows Getúlio Vargas, that I became what is now called a Brazil, was even then, but now I would recognize myself as a Brazilianist, a North American who was trained academically to study Brazil and write about Brazil, interpret Brazil, both for English language North American audiences and students in particular and scholars, but also to bridge understanding and scholarship between Brazil, you know, the United States and Brazil and other places in the world as well. And it's through that kind of early formation as a student in graduate school, and then eventually as a faculty member, that I became a historian of Brazil. But more broadly, I would call myself, and I still embrace an identity which can be troubling sometimes as a Brazilianist. And through that, my early research was on the Vargas period, mainly 20th century, 30s, 40s in particular, and I had some opportunities as a Fulbright scholar, and later as a Ford scholar to live in Brazil and to live in Rio in particular to do field research and publish some of that, my first book. And then from there to do a range of other things, mainly in 20th century Brazilian history, but much of that work was done in Rio, not necessarily early on about Rio, but in Rio. And in that process, I really became quite fascinated by the city and very committed to the city, and a very personal sort of emotive connection that I have to this city and as a place and experiences that I've had there. And that led me to this opportunity that I have had more recently to work on the Rio de Janeiro Reader, which is a work of history, but it's also a kind of a broad-based, multidisciplinary, multi-perspective attempt to capture and interpret and fracture our understandings about Rio de Janeiro, this marvelous, wonderful, terribly distressing place and city, and its 500 years of marveling and distressing people as well. So that's the kind of short way of saying my path has been both academic but also personal as well.
And I think that you and your fellow editors have put together a really fascinating collection of documents relating to Brazil. In the introduction, it's mentioned that the book will explore Rio in a variety of documents, from police investigations to Facebook pages. I wonder if you could just talk for a couple moments about how you decided on the types of documents that you were going to use, and perhaps some of the challenges relating to curating those documents.
Sure, it's an excellent question. It was very much part of the process. This final product is a both function of ideas and ideals about what we wanted to do, and then the practicalities of how to find that in a document, a source that was accessible, that was intelligible, translatable, and that we could secure the rights to republish. So given that the three co-editors were all historians, we all began with a kind of basic familiarity with archival manuscript documents in various ways, original documents, whether they were in handwritten or typed form or electronic form. And so that, informed, obviously, there was an archival basis to this. And so different archives that each of us had worked in our various research histories became a big foundation for this. And both the archives themselves and then the kind of research that each of us did and the periodization, both Amy and I had worked in the 20th century. Both Amy and I now work in the 19th century. Paulo's, for some of his research, has been in the colonial period. We had both a combination of the kind of chronological periodization kinds of interest and then this archival component. But with that, then we knew we had to expand out to look at other kinds of sources. So, that included, looking at things, material objects and museum things that are visual materials, and some based on our familiarity, some based on doing, research, discovering, reading, and internet searches and instruments, archival or manuscript or bibliographic instruments that would point us in directions. And that became, part of this big discovery process in which we had a big list. I don't remember how many items were on it, but a lot. And then we began to winnow those down and make some choices based on chronological coverage, based on document type, based on voice. certainly we wanted to have representations of men and women, Brazilians and non-Brazilians, Afro-Brazilians, Afro-Cariocas, and non-Afro-Cariocas, things related to public planning, things related to the everyday, crime, criminality, but from multiple perspectives, both from the perspective of the policing state and also those who are policed or you know, objects of police interest. And so those were each different items that ultimately led to some choices about where to go. And then from there, it became a process really of negotiating among ourselves and with the press about balance and about translation, both, you know, who would do it, if it was translated, who would, if it not, who would do a translation if it wasn't in English, but also how things could be translatable, you know, how could they be conveyed, whether the document was very short or longer, how could we could present it in a way that offered some coherence, some accessibility for the reader as well. And some of that also came to, you know, questions about making sure we capture contemporary or current, at least recent, Brazil and the new ways of expression. And that included something like Facebook pages as well, obviously a relatively new type of source, and developing new kinds of relationships too. So we found some Facebook pages from the Rede da Maré, but you know, I didn't have any connections there, but through our research assistants, and we made some connections and sort of asked if they would be interested and willing to have some of their materials translated and appeared, and sort of that kind of development of relationships as well to do that. And then, you know, I would say a good portion of what took place near the end of the process was getting the rights. You know, some things were in the public domain, some things weren't. Some things had to do with Brazilian law, others with the international law, depending on the author's nationality, the time in which it was appeared. And that took up a lot of, you know, time, oxygen, to make sure that each document ultimately was either in the public domain or was ceded to us to translate and publish, or that we paid a fee for that. And that was certainly the case for music. But maybe I should add, you know, there's some things in there which, you know, seemed so obvious to us, like the lyrics from The Girl from Ipanema. I mean, it just was so obvious that we would have that in there. But actually it's not, because securing the rights was just impossible. We tried, and the cost would have been exorbitant. And so we had to not do that. But the irony, of course, is that many of the things, such as The Girl from Ipanema, that are so familiar to Brazilian international audiences about Rio and are readily available through any Google search. So it's not that these are actually protected, but, you know, we couldn't secure the rights to actually print them in this particular document, so they don't appear. But those are some things that are, you know, that were lost, but we had other great things from newspapers and other individuals that were extremely helpful and willing, really, to offer materials to us to publish at no cost or very low, moderate, you know, just a nominal cost. So Claudio Fajeda's photography, for instance, which is fantastic. It's kind of a range of relationships and laws and balances of interest, balances of goals.
And I think what's really fascinating is that when you're discussing all of the challenges that went into creating this volume, you and the editors and the authors and the translators were able to cover an impressive amount of history. I mean, to do 450 years is quite incredible. And so I
wonder... No footnotes. The irony, of course, is we had to do it without footnotes.
Oh, and that's very true as well. That kind of leads a little bit into another question that I have, which is, what do you see as the benefit for someone to use a reader. When, you know, things like the Olympics and current events in Brazil are going on and someone wants to learn more about the country or about Rio, what benefit is there to sometimes using a reader for primary source documents as opposed to a more traditional historical monograph?
Sure. So one of the big benefits is just the multiplicity of voices. Certainly you have in this, and I think it is important to stress that this is a, you know, you use the word curated, or that, you know, there is a strong a selection and there's a voice from the co-editors here. That voice appears in the selection, even though that doesn't necessarily as obvious to a reader, but certainly you see that in the introductory essay, in the essays which introduce each of the four major sections, and each document itself has a 400-ish word introduction that is, you know, both factual but also is leading a reader to a certain kind of vision, a certain kind of set of questions to be asked of the document. But with that, all of that, and there's an attempt to create some cohesion and coherency there, some unified voice written by three people, synthesized. There are all these documents in there which are written by people at very different times and different, very different social positions and different relationships to the city. And so I think one of the advantages is you see the multiplicity. There's no way you can say Rio is or Cariocas are in a unified way by taking the reader. You can certainly say that Cariocas, you know, the history of Rio is a history of overcoming the physical obstacles of the city, creating this modern city in a tropical environment. And, you know, you can find that there, but you can also find all the ways in which that has not been the case, how there are other ways to approach the city, how the tropics and the tropical environment, the natural environment has continued to be something in which is in opposition to the modern city, or is it a tension as well. These aren't unified. And you hear that in from different voices, certainly when we think about that kind of arguments that Cariocas, Brazilians, but especially Cariocas, are sociable and they're friendly, but yet you find all kinds of evidence from different ways in which incredible amount of ongoing social tension, hostility, violence. And I think the reader provides not just an argument about that, but evidence. But evidence, again, from different perspectives, so that a reader, as in the person reading the book, reading the reader, as it were, has an ability to also come to their own narratives and to be able to choose or thread several documents together to create a narrative or an approach or an understanding that would be different than if this was a single authored monograph that told a certain story from a certain perspective, certainly in which the sources are opaque or even hidden or embedded only in footnotes, and that reader would not have access to the original materials to come both to some understanding, hopefully in agreement with what the author has, but also maybe their own opinions, concerns or questions. So I think that this is what a reader can do in an accessible way. Certainly it does a lot, takes out a lot of the work, or it makes more accessible primary sources, for instance, which often are hidden in archives and they're of difficult access and maybe difficult to understand in their own terms. You know, 18th century document looks weird and it's hard to read. But when it's, you know, when it's transcribed and translated and printed and introduced, one can still get a touch and a sensibility for the flavor and the problems of the 18th century, but also in a 21st century in a 21st century package or 21st century vehicle. And I think that's an important tool, opportunity for a range of readers, you know, certainly university students, but also the educated traveler, the interested person who's, has an interest in Rio or has an interest in Rio, but they're not quite sure what to do with it. They want something more than a travel guide, They want something different than something only that's going to be part of, you know, everyday journalism. And maybe they, you know, they want something to go alongside the novels that they read or the you know, the everyday experiences that they observe, you know, how to give them some tools to be able to understand, navigate those, make some sense of those.
And when you were discussing that component of a reader, and that there are certain themes that seem to stand out, you know, like the environment and politics and music. Were there any of these themes that seemed to be very prominent as you and the editors and writers were doing your research, and perhaps to the point where you might have to balance it with other elements to give a more well-rounded look at the city?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, this is the original idea was that, and kind of an idea that this would be done as an electronic, kind of an enhanced electronic book would be something called, what I called itineraries. So we would choose, there are 10 itineraries. So Black Rio, City of, we usually have the word City of, so it was like City of Sex, City of Waters, City of Fakes, City of Politics, I can't remember all the ones, City of Violence. And so these different themes, and they'd be City of, and in each of these themes or threads or itineraries, I always like this metaphor of the itinerary, one would select a number of documents of that theme. And sometimes that one document could be more than one theme. You know, it could be both something about violence and about blackness, for instance. But one would be able to do that and thread those. And so part of the idea was the choice about what our 10, I think it was 10 this time. There's a lot of work to try to figure those out. Now, in reality, we chose an organization that is chronological in the presentation there, and with some big chronological periods. But there's still this kind of underlying about these kind of big threads that I mentioned there. And it came to sometimes making some choices and trade-offs to make sure that those threads were represented. So certainly we had, you know, obviously a concern that we wanted to express the multiplicity of gendered voices. And so this was, you know, sometimes a challenge for especially the historical record, which, you know, suppressed, oppressed the voices and experiences of women. So we had to make some, you know, some concerted efforts sometimes to figure out if we can't, I couldn't always find a document that would be suitable written by a woman, at least the one written about women or the women at play into it. And so there were some components to about that. But, you know, when we think about blackness, for instance, we also wanted to be clear that blackness was not this uniform social experience, that all Afro-Cariocas were the same. And so making some selections which actually showed some hostilities, there's that document there about the capoeiras, in which this African is, you know, beat up by these other one's an African, one's Brazilian-born black. So, you know, there's this seems to be this hostility between African-born Africans and Brazilian-born blacks, people of African descent. And so that was, you know, a choice to be made also about how to create some subtle texture. And even dealing with things like, you know, the most stereotypical, seductive ideas about, you know, tropical Brazil and the city of sexuality and about the, you know, the mulata, the light-skinned woman is a samba dancer in the sambódromo. Certainly we knew that, you know, that's part of Rio. That's part of the image, the international image, but it's part of the internal image of Rio for Cariocas, not just for external. But, you know, rather than just go with something kind of tried and true, you know, we chose a Ministry of Health, HIV prevention carnival, you know, use a condom campaign in which there's this woman, you know, she's quite attractive, a mulatto woman, you know, and she's in this carnival costume, but her costume's all made out of condoms. You know, it's fantastic. You know, it appeals to what, you know, the kind of stereotypical images, but it does so in a and a black woman's or light-skinned woman of color's sexuality in Carnival in particular, but it does so in a very different way, both by, you know, public health, but also she has control over public health because she's wearing these condoms and she's going to use them. And her thing is, you know, if you don't have a condom, nothing's going to happen, is basically what it says in Portuguese. So this was fun, you know, but it was part of making some conscious choices, too, about how to represent voices and how to show variety, how to capture variety for a city which is a varied city.
And I think diving a little bit more into the sources that you curated for this marvelous city, I wonder if there's perhaps a specific type of source which proved to be interesting to curate, like government documents or song lyrics, or if there is perhaps an interesting story about how some of these sources might have been discovered.
Song lyrics, I think song lyrics, poetry, anything that was very creative. I mean, those are very, I think, difficult. Chacal, you know, the Varão da Lata. A Lata is a Chacal poem, which then it becomes the lyrics with Fernando Abreu about the summer of these cans of marijuana that wash up on the beach. That was tough, you know. It's song lyrics, but they're, you know, it's very much in a slang. But there's all this work going on about both to try to describe this historical moment, but also about drug culture and, you know, rebelliousness of drugs. But then it's also mapping out the city. It makes these references to these various places in the city that some of which I recognize right away, but... San Sebastián, there was a reference there. I had no idea what it was, and, you know, so that took some time. But I think more broadly, anything of that really poetic register, so song lyrics and poetry, were hard to translate. And one of the choices was made for those particular kinds of documents is to leave the original alongside the translation. To be really tipping off to the reader that, yeah, translation is another creative act, or it's an act of betrayal. And we want to be, you know, somewhat upfront about that. Some fun things that were fun to discover. So I will give you one anecdote. So there's late in the reader, there's a chapter about Manguinhos, the Biblioteca Parque Manguinhos. Manguinhos is a neighborhood, northern zone of Rio, you know, industrial, working class, lower middle class, a lot of favelas there as well. It's hard, you know, hard life kind of neighborhood, certainly not part of attractive, marvelous, spectacular Rio. And in this new relationship between public services and particularly libraries and communities, the city had built this new kind of library, this library park. And so, you know, we found the document from the written, you know, kind of a mission statement from the director, I think. And, you know, it's a very public official, in a kind of liberal reformist way, describing what this this Biblioteca Parque's mission is where the origins and how it's, you know, it's real relationship between library users, the library itself, the community. Interesting, great, you know, important. But then the library also did, you know, there was a functioning library, and they had this, have this online journal called Sector X, in which they have various, you know, people, users of the library who make contributions, writing, original, you know, creative writing, photography. And there was an interview with this guy, Alex Araújo. You know, I don't know, really, I've met or I've corresponded with Alex indirectly on email, but I've never met him. But there's this interview with him, and he's an aspiring writer, and he... the locksmith. He had a kind of failed locksmith business. He's aspiring writer. He wants to be a writer. And so it was fun, though, because, you know, the interviewer from the library was asking him, you know, what inspires you? And so one of the things he said, he said he's an escritor pesado. I think that's what his phrase is in Portuguese. So kind of a heavy, he's a heavy writer. And, you know, and he said, well, first of all, I say this is because I'm kind of heavy, overweight, so I assume he's overweight. So I thought it was kind of a nice, funny, sort of self-deprecating. But he says he's also grew up in this neighborhood, it's Barra Pesada, which is, a sort of slang term for, you know, rough, heavy violence. So he's making this reference to the violence in Manguinhos. So it's like, okay, so he goes from one level, from talking about his own weight, using the same kind of core word, pesado, pesada, to about the kind of the heaviness of his neighborhood. But then he says he was also inspired by these movies, these popular culture references. So Chira da Pesada, which I didn't know what it was, but it turned out to be the Beverly Hills Cop, but the Portuguese name of it, title of it. And then the other one was the Bernie Mac show, which I can't remember now the name of it in Portuguese, but it's Pesada. So, you know, to me, it was just fun. Like, here's this guy, he's a locksmith, apparently he's overweight, he had a failed business, but he wants to be a writer, he lives in this hard neighborhood, he's being interviewed for this magazine by this, you know, this new kind of form of a library, and he's also talking about what he watches, you know, on his DVDs, which have probably been pirated, of everything, and Bernie Mac. And I just thought that was great, fun. I mean, an everyday kind of person, but showing also this kind of everyday experience, but also this playfulness of both the world around him, but also how he's describing that and his playfulness with language. And I thought that was a great way, and it reminded me, like, many times when I'm with my Carioca friends, and, you know, they make all kinds of jokes and word plays, and, you know, I think that's funny and fun. And that was an unexpected find about, you know, a guy. To be honest, I don't know if he's been successful at being an author or not, but he's trying. And there's a lot of people who are trying to do all kinds of things, and whether they're successful or not, about exactly, they are part of the experience. So they're cariocas, and they're part of that you know, to be a carioca, and part is to want to be something. And so here's one person who's trying to be something. So, you know, that would be a great example of something that I found, which is very different than any of the kind of research that I do, or for the most part, the places that I frequent. I've been to Manguinhos just once, but it's not a neighborhood that I know well.
And I think that's sort of a perfect segue to talk about a couple of current events going on in Brazil. I think we certainly couldn't do an interview like this without discussing contemporary events, and especially the way in which Rio might influence some of those events. The first one that I'd like to talk about is relating to the Olympics. It's coming up in a couple of months, and there have been a number of stories that have come out about how the government has spent more money on the Olympics than they have on social services. And, you know, there's a lot of people who have become, I think, disaffected by that. So I wonder if you could just perhaps tell us a little bit about the role that Rio has played in terms of some of the unrest relating to the Olympics, and if you could perhaps give a prediction as to whether or not Brazil will be able to pull off the Olympics in a couple of months.
You know, that's the question that every single Brazilian asks themselves, and commentators about Brazil. So I would say yes, the Olympics will happen, and I think they'll probably be pretty successful. The majority of the venues are complete. Though the transportation to getting to and from those venues is, you know, not quite complete. I was just in Rio last week and a half ago. They're trying, you know, people, the games will take place, and they probably would be fairly successful as games events in and of themselves, and certainly for television, international spectator. And, you know, we have to remind ourselves that this is hardly the first major event that Rio has hosted. The World Cup was just 2 years ago, the Pan American Games, the World Youth Congress, you know, Rock in Rio. I mean, this is Echo 92. This is a city, we can go back to the Ecumenical Congress of 1955, or even, you know, some big events going back to the Centennial Exposition 1922, that somehow this is a city that can pull off major events, major world events, despite all of the problems that are part of the pulling the actual events off and the, you know, the legacy of them. So I think that that's important to recognize. And Cariocas are huge sports fans, or Brazilians, are huge sports fans. They're crazy about sports. And so a sporting event in a city that can and has this, you know, almost calling for putting on shows, I think will combine to have an Olympics that will be successful, largely successful. You know, I'm sure there are going to be some things which don't work out correctly, but, you know, I imagine the same thing happened in London and Sochi and Beijing, etc. I think that the bigger question, though, is at what cost and at what both direct cost but also the trade-offs. The direct costs are huge. I mean, the amounts of money, the amounts of waste that has gone along with those investments. Some of those investments will clearly be of enduring importance, some of the transportation investments. I suppose, you know, for some of these sporting venues will be repurposed, but, you know, the World Cup is an example. You know, you have to certainly some of those stadiums which are really not used. But I think the trade-off costs are probably much, the story there is much more difficult to really see in a positive light, or at least to be very optimistic. It's not that much of this investment would have taken place in other areas, but the fact that it is taking place in the context where there's an underinvestment or de-investment in public health and education are two big areas for the city of Rio and the state. Environment, pollution of Guanabara Bay. I mean, this is just, you know, it's stunning. It's mind-boggling that, you know, there could be so much progress and investment and enthusiasm and focus to build these Olympic sporting venues, but not to figure out how to increase sewage treatment so that the waters that the Olympics themselves are using, much less after the Olympics, that the waters in this wonderful city are not, you know, just filthy, polluted with human industrial waste and garbage. That is really stunning, and that those kinds of projects weren't incorporated. The health and the education, of course, the Olympics themselves are not those, you know, directly tied to health and education per se, but, you know, that the state of Rio in particular has faced this huge crisis in public health and education simultaneously, in part because of long-term poor planning, mismanagement, and the drop of petroleum prices. At the time these Olympics are going on, it just creates a very glaring contrast about priorities as part of it, but execution and focus and where resources, but also more importantly, what citizenship looks like. You know, what role that the state in particular should have. And then even in areas where you find, you know, the Ciclovia, so this Chimaya, wonderful, the bike path that was constructed for the Olympics or in time for the Olympics, I guess. You know, it certainly would be a picture, postcard, perfect shot for any NBC Olympic coverage. Opened up, 3 weeks ago? Though, you know, it had been under construction before that. And it collapsed. I mean, a portion of it collapsed 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, you think, how could this have happened? Like, how could this brand new structure that clearly should have been done in, you know, the highest standards in terms of engineering and execution, project management, how could it this be that it's only been open a week and it collapses from a wave, which was a big wave, but it wasn't like, you know, the storm of the century kind of wave. And that is, you know, shocking. And, you know, it's reflective of the mismanagement of resources, including those for specifically for the Olympics, the, you know, graft and corruption associated with contracting, the disregard for public safety and human life, or the kind of generalization of risk rather than its mitigation that is so endemic to public contracting and in some ways to life. That's a very over-dramatic way. Because for the most part, most Cariocas go about their day in a fairly normal, safe way. But it is a dangerous city as well. And how you have public infrastructure, which should be built to the highest standards for safety, for instance, are not, is really troubling and demoralizing. And you certainly can see this in the past, in historical past, and say, well, that was because it was a poor country, or it was, you know, ruled by oligarchs. Who knows? I mean, you can come up with a lot of arguments about why. But, you know, why now at this moment, particularly when this global moment? And Rio itself is leading a Brazilian aspiration to be a full member of the developed world in terms of its economic and social and political arrangements. And it's not. I mean, this is an indication that it doesn't. It's not. And that's very troubling for, you know, it's both heartbreaking, just emotionally heartbreaking, but it's also very troubling for when you think about the kind of larger context in which the underutilization of capacity or the suppression of human capacity and the city's capacity because of bad execution, cynicism, corruption is hard to take.
And I think that's also a very excellent summary of the ways in which issues around the Olympics have taken on a very political form, and that some of the underlying issues that you talked about really underscore some of the dissatisfaction that Cariocas as well as other Brazilians have with their government. So I wonder if you could perhaps give us a sense of the way that you think the tension right now regarding Dilma and others might be resolved, if it might ultimately end with impeachment, or if there might be some other political resolution that might come about.
Well, I mean, specific for President Rousseff, which is not certainly not a Rio City problem or even a Rio State problem. It's a national problem. Though there is it's interesting to see that, you know, some of the major players are from the state of Rio. Eduardo Cunha, the now somewhat suspended Speaker of the House, President Rousseff's main adversary, is from the state of Rio. Bolsonaro, right now, one of the kind of major notorious figures of the far right, is also from the state of Rio. You know, given what I read in the paper and see, I think that the Dilma's political fate is she has very, very slim chances of not being removed or they have her power suspended very soon. The vote is today or tomorrow. It's possible she'll be able to successfully defend herself in the full trial in the Senate, though I think that that's difficult, in part because of this more broad-based collapse of public support, including from those in her own party, but also in part her political skills are just maybe she was the right person at the wrong time, but in a period of crisis, political and economic crisis, she has not proven to be very skillful or adept at managing a difficult economic situation and a hostile political situation, but one in which in a multi-party system, possibly, she were better able to navigate that, would maybe not lead toward impeachment. Not necessarily that she'd be as successful as she would like, but certainly to impeachment. So it's quite possible, but her Vice President Temer doesn't really seem to have a strong political place or program. And so it's not as if there is in the wings an alternative faction or group with a vision. I mean, there are a lot of language about anti-corruption, and you'll find this important in Rio City, and you'll among the middle classes and elites. But you'll also find fear and anxiety about the end, the curtailment of social services and social programs. Again, in Rio, among those people who are most better beneficiaries of them, people see Bolsa Familia, Casa Minha Vida, these other social service programs, but also everyday people who don't necessarily benefit from those, maids, for instance, who are domestics, who might find that some of the gains made under the new domestic workers' laws, protection laws, would be eroded without the defense of the PT and in the Ministry of Labor. Those are there. Rio's in this particular city, in particular juncture of being the host city for the Olympics, and so there's some focus of trying to not be so entangled in the events in Brasilia, in part because of this international gaze / pressure to perform for the Olympics. Rio State, more broadly, is in this very serious economic crisis because of the collapse of oil and kind of a political development project, which was very tied to petroleum revenues, and that those have not come to be recently. So those, it's a very difficult conjuncture. Historically, and even today, I would say that Rio becomes the proxy for all of Brazil. So though it is autonomous, it has its own particular dynamic, it becomes what takes place in Rio is a proxy for all of Brazil, and certainly in the international imaginary, but also Rio itself with its very strong media, in particular media industries, historically also economic power, which is not nearly as strong as it used to be historically. For internationally, so you don't just use, from a very shorthand way, these economist covers, first Brazil taking off, and what is Brazil taking off? It's the image of Christ the Redeemer and this rocket taking off, and then something's going wrong, and again, it's Christ the Redeemer, but it's a rocket, and it's like spiraling down and crashing. And then the most recent one with the Christ the Redeemer again holding up an SOS. So these are stories in the Economist, and this is one example. I'm trying to discuss all of the country, but it becomes a kind of shorthand about an iconic image of the country, which is a Carioca image, Christ the Redeemer on Corcovado. And I think that is one of the real power that Rio has to set an agenda, a language for all of Brazil, but also a burden. That all kind of being said, though, that this particular moment of political crisis also in terms of the image is one that plays out in a kind of spectacle way in the streets of Rio and certainly in the streets of Sao Paulo, but also in Brasilia. And Brasilia being the capital has its own particular kind of place for this right now, both outside the capital chambers, but also within those chambers themselves, which is a reflective for Rio. It's a different moment. It's no longer the capital. When we look back to other moments of political crisis, the events that led to Vargas' suicide in 54, the coup against Vargas in 1945, the revolution in 1930, the Proclamation of the Republic, 1889. Those are all Rio events. They're national in scope, but they're Rio events because of Rio being the capital, and that's where both the seat of government is, but also the head of state. And that is not the case right now, and so that changes the dynamic. But nonetheless, I still think that it's important to recognize that when we talk and we see this imagery about contemporary crisis in Brazil, you know, we're not seeing most of Brazil. We're seeing images from a select number of places, and Rio is usually one of the top three of those places.
And in regards to Rio and being the focus for a particular reader, I know a number have been published on countries throughout Latin America. There's a Brazil reader that's been done, another on Chile and Argentina, but I believe this is the first reader that has been published on a specific city. So I wonder if you had the opportunity to publish a second reader on another city in Latin America, which city do you think would be that focus?
Well, Duke University Press it has been very, very successful with these country readers, as they're called. And so they are hoping, or the intent is to develop out city readers as well to go, to be the companion. When we began this project, several others were already in production. I believe they still are, but in part because of the timing of the Olympics, and in part just because we were able to do it, we got ours two out. But certainly I would agree that some of the other ones that are in development, Buenos Aires, Lima, Mexico City, Havana, are all cities very, very worthy of readers. And I would, I look forward to reading those myself. The challenge for me personally for taking any of those on is that I think to really do this well, one has to be bicultural, bilingual, and have spent a lot of time in a city to get a sense of just space, neighborhoods, distance, to be able to try to capture that. So, though I have lived in Buenos Aires for, 5 months or so doing some research, I don't know if I could do it because I don't have I would have to approach it in a very academic kind of way and not necessarily also connecting to some of the both personal but also the kind of social emotive parts of that. I think instead someone who's either Porteño, who then happens also to be able to think about how an English language audience would want to understand Buenos Aires, or a North American or English language person who has spent a lot of time in Buenos Aires would be better positioned. And I would say the same thing for places like Havana, Mexico City, Lima, Cusco, in Brazil, Sao Paulo, Salvador, places. But I think that this model could certainly be used for other kinds of cities. And I live in Washington, D.C. right now, and I've lived here for 20-some years. And I think, it would take a fair amount of work, but I think I could do something for Washington, D.C. In a way that would be faithful, at least respectful, of the endeavor to try to capture a city that is, again, very complex and multiplicitous. So, but again, I think that the most important thing is that, people are doing this with a lot of passion and experience. And I've had the opportunity to do this for Rio, and I hope that others were able to do it for some other cities.
And we certainly look forward to additional readers for other cities if those things are in the works. We've certainly taken up a lot of your time today, Dr. Williams. So with respect to new projects, I wonder if you could just close out the interview for us by perhaps talking about a current project that you might be working on, or perhaps one you've finished, or one that you hope to start in the immediate future.
Yeah, so I should say, one extension to the Rio Reader right now, which is kind of my project, so I'm talking about this book and this Olympic moment in the city, is that I signed up for Twitter, and so I'm tweeting pretty much every day, at least one or two tweets about Rio and some components. So sometimes I'm retweeting contemporary news, and with the crisis in Brazil, there's certainly lots to do there. But sometimes I also pull things out that are directly associated with the reader, other things inspired by the reader, and other just random. I found this, you know, there was this yogi in the early 60s who predicted that Rio was going to be destroyed in a tidal wave, a tsunami. I posted this. You know, it actually expands out the opportunities to do the reader, moving this into social media without having to go through all the work of finding the documents, translating them, you know, getting them ready, translating them, getting the rights, because, you know, since I'm just linking to them, it's not so much a problem. And so I really look forward to that, and I've noticed that out of that I've been able to build up a kind of parallel Rio Reader in social media, which is interesting, and it extends some of the topics there directly, and others have added some new ones. So I really look at the Rio Reader as something that's continued to grow and take on a life. And so, you know, follow me on Twitter, my full name, Daryl Williams, or the hashtag Rio Reader, and you can see a little bit more of that. In terms of my own scholarship, I'm trying to very diligently to finish a monograph, a book, a scholarly book, which looks at the experience of freedom in 19th century Brazilian slave society, and particularly about Rio, principally, and this group of Africans who were illegally enslaved and then liberated during the suppression of the trade. So they were on ships that were captured by British, sometimes Brazilian, but mainly British cruisers in between the 1830s and 1850s, and liberated because they had been illegally trafficked. And so it's this experience that they have of being illegally enslaved, but then freed, but in Brazil, in the world's largest and most enduring slave society, and particularly in Rio, one of the largest slave cities ever in the Americas. And so they have a very particular kind of experience, but one that is unique to this group. They're called free Africans or liberated Africans. Emancipados is another term. But at the same time, it's also one that's shared with many more Africans who were illegally enslaved and never rescued. And those Africans, people of African descent, born into slavery in Brazil. And so kind of looks at their experiences as blacks, but in this kind of variety of blacks and blackness, using a lot of documentation has been suitable for some digital humanities projects, because a lot of the information about them comes from these lists or the registers taken when the ships are seized and rescued, and the liberated Africans are liberated, they're giving names, and then later they're liberated again in the 1850s and 60s, and so some lists that have been suitable for some digital humanities work that I've done at Stanford and more recently at Michigan State University. But also there's the incredible people, human stories in there, mainly told through these petitions that these various Africans wrote for all kinds of things, but particularly for their freedom. One of those stories is in the Rio Reader. There's a Maria Angola, also goes by Maria Ebola, who was illegally enslaved, arrives in Brazil, it's not exactly clear, but around 1840 and in the early 1850s, lodges this complaint with the British consul that her son, Eugenio, 3-year-old son, had been illegally enslaved. She herself had been illegally enslaved originally, but she had been liberated, and she had been working under the kind of forced apprenticeship of this Portuguese guy. But this Portuguese guy, there was a scheme, had tried to baptize Maria's son as a slave and treat him as a slave. And so she's complaining about this, and so you get to her voice. She goes to the British consul, and she registers this complaint. And then you see some responses there. So that's a human story, you know, about a mother and a child, mother trying to protect her child and to save her child from enslavement, a woman who knew enslavement herself, but who was free, had been freed. And so there are, you know, hundreds of stories like that from different kinds of documents. I'm trying to make a kind of larger argument about not just the experience that these Africans have, but also what that experience and what their particular agency means for understanding freedom as a concept, liberty as a concept, and eventually also as a legal practice in Brazil from the 1830s up through the 1860s, leading up to the eve of the moment when the freedom laws passed, in which, from a legal perspective, the Brazil becomes a slave society, which eventually will end slavery eventually after many generations, many decades. But look at that period prior to that and how these free Africans worked and experienced freedom and slavery. And so that will be a book that I'm hopefully going to be finishing in about the next year, well, less than that, that I've been working on for quite some time. And that's tied into, obviously, some things which I've touched on, the Rio Reader, but also tied to my more recent research, which moved from originally from the 20th century to the 19th. And Brazilian 19th century slavery, slave society is just a large and fascinating, complex, very interesting historical topic that... on its own terms, but also to put Brazil in dialogue with the United States and Cuba and Haiti and the Americas and then the broader Atlantic African diaspora as well.
It certainly does sound like a very fascinating project, and I think we certainly wish you the best in terms of completing it, and we look forward to reading the. I know it sounds a little bit on the morbid side, but we certainly do wish you the best for that, and we look forward to reading the book when it's published.
Thank you. It's a project which it's taken some time, but it has some interesting. It will be a historical monograph on its own terms. But I think particularly with the digital humanities components to this, somewhat maybe like the Rio Reader, is also there going to be some components of this that are going to exist outside of a traditional book format. So in these digital humanities ones, the Liberated Africans Project is what it's called at Michigan State, and Broken Paths of Freedom at Stanford University are ways in which scholarship can just exist outside of books, the form of the book, but also it can exist in different ways, sometimes more interactive, and also ways that provides a user, a reader, in some of the raw materials. So you'll find in both of these digital humanities projects the data set, and that the data set can be manipulated in ways that I don't necessarily find interesting. Not that I don't find interesting, it's just that it's not my particular research agenda. And I think that this, again, is a way that we're in a moment right now where it's important not just to share our research and our arguments and our findings, but also to share. We have the capacity to do this in part through digital technologies to share the kind of raw data and allow other people, in a sometimes guided way, but sometimes also you figured out on your own what might be made of historical materials and the historical experiences that are captured in those materials.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Dr. Darrell Williams is an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland. He is one of the editors for the Rio de Janeiro Reader, and he is also the author of Culture Wars in Brazil, The First Vargas Regime, from 1930 to 1945. Which is also published by Duke University Press. Dr. Williams, thank you once again for taking the time to speak with us.
Keith, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed this.
Once again, this has been Keith Simmons, host of New Books in Latin American Studies for the New Books Network. Until next time.